My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
So you're curious about relationships. Mm. You want to get, you know, the full picture, what works, what doesn't, all of it.
Right. And you want to get up to speed quickly without reading tons of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what we're doing today. We've gathered some really interesting material.
Yeah, we've got stuff from Very Well Mind on Relationship Types, a Reddit thread that got pretty heated about relationship advice.
Oh, yeah, that one. Plus, insights on attachment styles from Columbia Psychiatry, Mark Manson, on long distance.
Which is always a tricky one. And then there's a psychology textbook chapter covering, well, everything from meeting someone to group dynamics.
And we even have some visuals in the mix. A marching band, some interesting lab rats.
Uh-huh, a meeting in Rwanda, and a mouse looking out for number one.
So our mission today, pretty simple, really. We're going to pull out the key nuggets about all these different relationships and, you know, what makes them tick.
Okay, let's dive in. What's really striking, first off, is just how many types of relationships there are.
All right. The Very Well Mind stuff gives a good map. You've got acquaintances, friends, family, partners.
Romantic, sexual partners, work colleagues, even those, like, situational ones, your coffee guy.
And the point they make is that these aren't just separate buckets. They all weave together.
Yeah, exactly. They form this social support network. Mm-hmm. And that's just vital for our well-being, our health, really.
Okay, so let's zoom in a bit on the romantic side. It gets complicated fast.
Definitely. Sternberg's triangle of love is a helpful way to think about it. You know, passion, intimacy, commitment.
That initial rush, the passion, that's all neurotransmitters, apparently. Mm. Dopamine, oxytocin, all that good stuff.
Yeah, the can't stop thinking about them phase. But that initial intensity, it naturally fades a bit over time, doesn't it?
It does. And that's where the other parts, like intimacy and commitment, become so important.
Right. If couples work on deepening that emotional connection, that understanding,
they can handle it when the passion, you know, ebbs and flows. It becomes less of a crisis.
Exactly. Which is a really different picture from, say, codependency.
Ah, yes. Very well. Mine talks about that, too. It's that unbalanced thing, isn't it?
Totally. A real giver-taker dynamic. They list signs like, always needing permission, feeling like you have to rescue the other person.
Losing your own sense of self in the process.
Yeah, and feeling like you have to make the other person happy, even if it makes you miserable. It can happen in any relationship, not just romantic ones.
And that idea that it's co-constructed is interesting.
It is. Like, one person is maybe quite needy, and the other person gets something out of being needed. Maybe it helps them avoid their own stuff.
Hmm, makes sense. Okay, what about some of the more modern terms, like casual relationships?
Right. Casual can mean a lot of different things. One-night stands, friends with benefits, booty calls.
The Very Well Mind article points out it's really a spectrum, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. How often you see each other, what you talk about, if there's any real friendship there. It varies hugely.
It seems pretty common, especially for younger adults.
It is. And it can meet certain needs, sex, intimacy, connection, without the full commitment package. The key thing, though,
communication and consent.
Absolutely. Got to be clear. And that leads into open relationships, too.
Consensual non-monogamy, where partners agree they can see other people.
Yeah, under specific conditions, usually. There might be rules or limits they agree on.
There's still some stigma around it, I think.
For sure. But the research they mentioned, like 21-22% of adults experiencing it at some point, that's actually pretty significant.
Oh, yeah, more common maybe than people realize. Especially among men and LGBTQ plus folks, the article said.
Right. The benefits are obvious, like sexual freedom. But the pitfalls are there, too. Jealousy, emotional pain.
So again, it comes down to boundaries and communication.
Crystal clear boundaries. Personal, emotional, sexual, and just talking constantly.
Which inevitably brings us to the dark side. Toxic relationships.
Yeah. Ones that just drain you, make you feel ashamed, misunderstood, unsupported.
And the list of signs is pretty long. Lack of support, blaming, control, disrespect.
Gaslighting, hostility, jealousy, it's grim. And it can happen in any relationship type. Friendships, family.
Not just romantic partners. And it can come from one person. Or sometimes both contribute. Maybe because of past issues.
And it's not just emotionally damaging. They mention impacts on, like, heart health and loneliness. It's serious stuff.
So the advice is usually Strong boundaries, maybe therapy or...
Or getting out, if it's really harmful, which contrasts sharply with what a healthy relationship looks like. Trust, respect, honesty.
Good communication being key, again.
Always. And showing you care, appreciating the other person. Simple stuff, but vital.
Okay, so with all that as a backdrop, let's talk about that Reddit thread.
Oh, boy. Yeah, a cool guide to healthy relationships. It did not go over well.
Not at all. People really reacted negatively, calling it misleading, even saying it promoted infidelity or gaslighting.
The comments about opposite-sex friendships really seemed to hit a nerve for some, and the perception that it was pushing ethical non-monogamy.
People were questioning the author's motives, suggesting there was an agenda.
It just goes to show how vastly different people's core beliefs are about what healthy actually means, especially around monogamy.
Yeah, the backlash was intense. It really shows how personal and maybe culturally loaded these ideas are. Healthy isn't one size fits all.
Absolutely not. And it highlights how we react when advice seems to challenge our own deeply held values. People get defensive, you know?
Makes sense. And it raises questions about where relationship advice comes from, doesn't it? Like the Reddit user's suspected bias.
Definitely. Okay, shifting gears a bit. Attachment styles. Columbia Psychiatry's take is really insightful here.
Yeah, the whole idea that our first bonds, usually with caregivers, shape our later relationships, that's attachment theory, right?
That's the core of it.
Yeah.
And those three styles, they talk about anxious, avoidant, secure. They seem to explain a lot of common patterns.
Anxious is that fear of abandonment, needing reassurance.
Right. While avoidant is more needing love, but keeping people at arm's length emotionally.
Insecure is, well, the ideal, maybe. Comfortable with intimacy, trusting.
Pretty much. And what's useful is thinking about this early on. They suggest it's almost like interviewing someone for a big role in your life.
That's a good way to put it. Understanding their style gives you clues about potential compatibility or challenges.
For sure. Like, they mention anxious and avoidant styles often clash. It takes real effort and self-awareness from both sides to make that work.
Okay, let's tackle long distance now. Mark Manson's perspective. He's pretty direct, isn't he?
Yeah. No sugarcoating. He cuts right through the romantic haze.
He talks about needing something to look forward to together. Always.
Yes. That's crucial. Without that next visit, those future plans, that converging trajectory, he calls it, things just fizzle out. Enthusiasm dies.
It makes sense. Relationships need to feel like they're going somewhere.
Totally. And his advice to be slow to judge when you're apart, also very smart.
Because distance breeds assumptions.
Exactly. Jealousy gets magnified. You might overcriticize small things, or you swing the other way and idealize them like crazy.
You lose the day-to-day reality check.
Right. And his point about communication is interesting, too. Don't force it constantly.
That feels counterintuitive. Most advice is communicate more.
I know. But he argues it can breed resentment, that feeling of I'm sacrificing more here.
Yeah.
Make it optional, driven by actual desire to connect.
And use that desire as a sort of health check for the relationship.
Yeah, kind of a barometer.
Excellent.
And fundamentally, the distance has to feel temporary.
There needs to be a shared goal, an endpoint where you'll actually be together.
If there's no sense you're working towards closing the gap, people just drift apart. It's almost inevitable.
He also mentioned seeing the whole person, warts and all, which distance hides.
Yes, the idealization trap. You miss the little everyday quirks, the boring stuff, the slightly annoying habits that are part of the real person.
So long distance can work. But it's tough.
Very tough. Like most relationships, really. But he does say it can be worth trying, even just for what you learn about yourself.
Okay, interesting. Let's switch to the more academic view now, the psychology textbook chapter.
Yeah.
It starts with how relationships even form.
Right, and it covers a lot of ground. Sociocultural factors, biology, how we think.
The cultural angle is fascinating. This idea that intense romantic love is mostly a Western thing.
Yeah, and that in many cultures, love is expected to grow after marriage, not necessarily before it.
Arranged marriages being seen more as family alliances for stability and raising kids.
And the research suggesting they can be just as stable and satisfying, sometimes more so. That really challenges Western assumptions, doesn't it?
It does. And things like just who's available nearby, the field of availables used to be huge.
But technology has changed that game completely, hasn't it? Now your field of availables is potentially global.
True. Though those initial social cues, body language, facial expressions, they still matter in assessing someone.
Oh, definitely. And then there's the biology, the MHC genes, pheromones, suggesting we're drawn to people who give potential kids a good mix of immunity genes.
Wow. And facial symmetry being a sign of good genes or development. It's all happening subconsciously, right?
Mostly, yeah. Even things like how physiological arousal, like your heart beating faster, can be mistaken for attraction in the right context.
And cognitively, how we interpret those signals, whether we see someone as similar to us, our own self-esteem, it all plays a role.
It's a complex mix. Which leads us to communication, which the textbook stresses is absolutely vital.
Not just talking, but listening and understanding.
Right. Gottman's work on those four horsemen, criticism, defensiveness, stonewalling, contempt, is really powerful.
Contempt being the worst one, apparently. The real relationship killer.
Yeah, that feeling of disgust or superiority, though just being angry sometimes isn't necessarily bad if you handle it constructively.
And that point about really getting your partner's feelings being key for satisfaction, even in traditional arranged marriages.
It's universal. Then there are those potential gender differences. They mention women may be disclosing more, men may be interrupting more.
Which can cause friction if you're not aware of it.
Definitely. And that Knapp and Vangelisti model, the stages of coming together and coming apart. It's a useful way to see how communication changes as relationships evolve or decline.
And how we respond to bumps in the road, those patterns of accommodation.
Exactly. Do you discuss things openly, forgive, try to be patient? That's constructive.
Or do you use the silent treatment, bring up old fights, avoid the issue?
That's destructive. And too much of that destructive pattern really predicts negative outcomes, even the relationship ending.
The book also looks at why relationships change over time, like how our feelings affect how we explain our partner's behavior.
Yeah, attribution changes. If you're happy, you give them the benefit of the doubt. If you're not, maybe not so much.
And that social exchange theory, the cost-benefit analysis we're always doing, even if we don't realize it.
Are the rewards outweighing the costs? Is the investment balanced? Plus, bigger societal shifts matter too.
Like women's financial independence, less stigma around divorce.
Absolutely. People have more options, power dynamics shift. People might leave relationships later in life simply because we live longer now.
Okay, and finally, the textbook touches on group dynamics. How does that fit in?
Well, all our relationships happen within groups, right? Families, communities, workplaces.
Okay. So things like social identity theory, in groups and out groups.
Exactly. How we categorize ourselves and others, it leads to favoring our own group, maybe being negative towards others. Think about that marching band visual.
Right. Strong group identity means strong cooperation.
Precisely. And competition between groups can make that us versus them feeling even stronger. The lab rat cartoon kind of hits on that too, right? How easily we make distinctions.
Yeah, even arbitrary ones like eye color in the cartoon.
It shows how prejudice can build from competition or even just perceived difference. Culture and religion can play into that too, sadly.
The book mentions the Gacaca courts in Rwanda as a conflict resolution example.
Yeah, community-based, focused on dialogue, confession, apology, rooted in that idea of Ubuntu shared humanity.
But it wasn't perfect. There were challenges, bias, some issues weren't addressed well.
Important caveats, and then bystanderism, why people don't always help.
Diffusion of responsibility. The more people around, the less likely any one person acts.
Right. And who we help often depends on perceived similarity. Are they like us? Plus empathy and how much it might cost us to help.
So even helping behavior is tied into these group identity ideas.
It often is. But there are ways to promote positive behavior, like the kindness curriculum or emotion coaching they mentioned, teaching empathy and self-regulation early on.
It all sounds incredibly complex to research properly.
No, it is. The textbook ends by highlighting the ethical challenges. Informed consent is huge. You can't pressure people.
And being sensitive, avoiding harm. What about methodology?
Big challenges there, too. People act differently when they know they're being studied. That's reactivity. Or they try to look good, social desirability bias.
So researchers need to be aware of their own influence.
Absolutely. That's reflexivity. Mm. And it's hard to generalize findings because people and relationships are just so diverse. You need multiple approaches.
Okay, wow. So wrapping this all up, the big takeaway is just how incredibly complex relationships are.
Definitely. It's not just feelings. It's psychology, society, culture, even biology, all tangled together.
And the aha moment for me, I think, is seeing the connections, how things like trust and communication are vital everywhere.
Exactly. They're key in a marriage, but also key for a team working well together or even resolving community conflicts. The underlying principles overlap.
So for you listening, hoping to get a handle on all this without drowning in details, maybe thinking about these core ideas gives you a framework.
Yeah, it's less about having the answers and more about having better ways to think about the questions, about the connections you see and experience.
Which leads to a final thought, maybe. Knowing all these factors are involved, psychological, social, cultural, biological, how could understanding them better help you build more fulfilling connections?
Something to think about. Maybe one specific area we touched on, attachment or communication or long-distance challenges, really struck a chord and is worth exploring more on your own.